Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
And welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Chris Wojtek from St. Xavier University, and today we'll be talking to Albert Wu from the American University in Paris about his new book, From Christ to Confucius, German Missionaries, Chinese Christians, and the Globalization of Christianity from 1860 to 1950. Albert Wu, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Albert, I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I was born in the U.S., but I grew up mainly in Taiwan. I moved back with my parents when I was 6 years old and spent ages 6 to 18 there. And then I came as an undergrad to the U.S. I studied history at Columbia University in New York, where I studied a combination of European and American history. And after that, I spent a year in Europe because I knew I needed to sort of get better at languages and applied to study history at the University of California, Berkeley. And I got my PhD there in 2013. And the dissertation that I wrote is essentially the book. And I studied the relationship between Germany and China. I was sort of trained simultaneously as a European historian and a Chinese historian. And after I got my PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, I moved to Paris, where I've been teaching for the past 3 years. At Paris, I teach a combination of courses, European history, but also global history, and the past year, since September, I've been a postdoctoral fellow on a Humboldt Foundation fellowship in Berlin, sort of working on the second book project.
Well, I was actually going to be, and you started to answer that a little. That was going to be one of my questions. Do you consider yourself like a German historian, a historian of missions, sort of a global or transnational historians, or how do you see yourself fitting into that framework?
I definitely started grad school thinking of myself primarily as a European historian. And I was trained, my main advisor was Peggy Anderson, who's a 19th century German religious historian. And I started out definitely feeling like I was going to go more into German religious history. And As my graduate stint, is that the right word? Or my graduate career
tour.
Yes. I felt pulled increasingly more towards the transnational. Actually, it was primarily my advisor who encouraged me. She said, "Well, you have this background in Taiwan and in these." And you have this training in these Asian in Chinese, so you should definitely take advantage of that. And so I became increasingly more drawn to transnational history and Chinese history as well. I didn't really take much Chinese history as an undergrad, and it wasn't really until graduate school that I started a serious study of modern Chinese history. So I think I still, back to your original question, I feel like I primarily see myself as a European historian in terms of the questions that I ask about the fundamental issues that I'm interested in, such as religious conflict. But I think I'm framing it more within a transnational framework or a broader global context. And I'm starting to see more and more that you can't really understand these fundamentally, quote-unquote, European issues without placing them in this global frame.
And that absolutely comes out in the book, which, by the way, I totally forgot to say, I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
Speaking of that, you know, sort of, how did you get on this topic specifically? You were obviously working with Peggy Anderson, thinking mm-hmm. about using your expertise, but how did you start thinking about missionaries?
Yeah, so as an undergrad, I was interested in religious history. My first week in college was September 11th.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, so I guess I was always interested in how religion shaped political action and vice versa, or how political mm-hmm. Behaviors shaped religion. So I guess religious history questions were sort of on my mind. So when I got to graduate school, my first project was actually on prison reform in Germany in the 19th century. And it was led by a group of these religious reformers at the head of the Intermission, what they called the Intermission, this reformer named Wickern. Johann Heinrich Wickern was sort of my main character that I was following. And essentially it was sort of the project was about conservative evangelical, quote unquote, evangelical reformers who tried to change the prison system along sort of more of a American model, if you will. And as I sort of looked at these reformers, I realized that the Intermission was completely tied in with the outer mission too. And so I got pushed more and more to looking at what people were thinking about, not just inside of the German lands, but also outside of the German lands in Asia and Africa. And so it started out as sort of a 19th century social question project, and then sort of emerged from there. So all that's to say is that most of the missionaries that I'm interested in, or that I looked at for this project at least, are more from the conservative theological spectrum. So I was interested in sort of what these conservative missionaries were doing, how they understood their project, how they justified it theologically, as opposed to, I think, which the more familiar narrative, at least among missionary studies, German missionary studies, like the liberals, like Richard Wilhelm, for example, mm-hmm. who's much more familiar, I think, in most historical narratives.
Now, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, you're segueing yourself very beautifully, by the way. You talked a little bit about how these conservative missionaries, and there's several groups that you focus on. You talk about the Berlin Missionary Society. Mm-hmm. You talk about the Society of the Design Word. Can you talk a little bit about who these folks are, what their thoughts are regarding China, why China is a place that they start to look when they do in the late 19th century.
Right. Great. So both I designed the project to be cross-confessional. Mm-hmm. Most of the missionary studies, whether it be in the American Anglo-American sphere or the French sphere for that matter, or German sphere, most of them are studies of either single denominations or of single confessions, like either Protestant or Catholic histories. So when I was looking into writing the book or the dissertation, I wanted to make the project comparative between. So I chose the largest or most arguably the most influential missionary societies in China. And I'll get to the question about why China in a little bit, but as both the Berlin Missionary Society and the Society of the Divine Word, which is the Catholic Society, were products of the 19th century religious revival. Mm-hmm. The Berlin Missionary Society is older. It was founded essentially in 1824, but the founders of the society were all sort of awakened Pietist leaders. Many of them had ties to the Prussian state. So they basically could draw on a certain amount of state support from the Prussian state, but they also essentially had quite a bit of a sort of Pietist revivalist outlook. And essentially what that meant was that they were anti-Enlightenment. They thought that the Napoleonic invasions of the early 19th century were a product of the French Enlightenment, and that their mission, so to speak, was to re-evangelize both the German lands, but also the lands abroad. The Catholic Society of the Divine Word, on the other hand, is also a product of sort of the Catholic revivals of the mid-19th century, also sort of anti-Enlightenment and outlook, but they're founded much later and in a different sort of set of political context, which is that they were a product of the Kulturkampf. And even though most of their founders were Germans, the initial founding or the initial house where the Society of the Divine Word was housed was in the Netherlands in Style. So they had to move across the border because religious orders were banned by Bismarck under the Kulturkampf initially. So both of them have this very particular outlook, are very much forged in this moment of 19th century religious revival, but also both the difference between them is that they have sort of very different relationships to the German state. The Berlin Mission Society, to some extent, much closer to the Prussian state, and the Society of the Divine Word to some extent, much more antagonistic towards it. And so that's sort of the background of them and why they're interested in China. For both, so the Berlin Mission Society actually starts out sending most of their missionaries to Africa. So their earliest missions is actually in I think what we now call modern day South Africa. They essentially are inspired by some of the missionary tales, especially this missionary named Karl Gutzlaff, who goes to China. He sort of partakes in the Opium Wars, and he comes back to Germany and sort of whips up a China fervor. and sort of regales people with all these tales about China. They basically start sending missionaries to China more seriously in the 1860s. The Society of the Divine Word, on the other hand, they start out wanting to go to China. And for them, the reason that they want to go to China is primarily a statistical or numerical one. I think at one point they say China is the land of our great hope and our great desires. And they basically say if we can convert even a percentage of the 555 million people, which is the statistic they quote at the time, this would be a major boon for our mission. So for them, they basically start out by sending missionaries to China from the beginning.
I loved that bit where they were going to balance the books. And part of this, and something that you do is that you talk about how their motivations are not just about evangelizing to the Chinese, but correcting the sort of tide of secularism that they see in Europe more broadly. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so in the 19th century, part of what I was trying to say about the religious revival is that the missionaries see themselves as being beleaguered by the rise of Enlightenment forces. And so they see this moment of expanding abroad as, right, exactly like you said, elegantly, a moment to balance the books and sort of regain the lost souls globally. But they also see it not only as a moment to sort of regain territory the way the Jesuits did in the early modern period, but they also see they also see their goal as inspiring the faithful in Europe to be recommitted to church causes. So donations are a big part of this. They say to in their missionary journals, you know, you should give a little bit to the missions as a way to show your piety. You know, the missionaries are those who are basically enacting this path of martyrdom or going on these really dangerous quests. But you, as a member of the congregation in Germany, you can do your part by reading our missionary journals, by contributing a little bit each week. And a big part of the success of these missionary societies in the 19th centuries is the amount of lay donations that they're able to receive. So both the Society of the Divine Word and the Berlin Mission Societies essentially do most of their work without state support. I mean, obviously, when they get into the colonies or when they get into East Asia, they're very much reliant on the state to do certain things for them. But in Germany, the Society of the Divine Word is able to expand because they're able to sell a lot of copies of their journals, sell a lot of, trinkets and their missionary festivals each year when missionaries come back and tell tales of exciting adventures in China and Africa or whatnot are extremely popular. So I think it's not only a matter of sort of winning the statistical table worldwide, but also reigniting the faithful to become more devoted to certain church causes.
Now your cross confessional framing kind of lets you look at the way that these different societies sort of communicate with each other and kind of learn from, and of course they don't always, but they sort of learn from each other's failures, right? And you've got this failure as sort of a framework. You've got in your introduction, you talk about the missionary perceptions of failure. Mm-hmm. In the third chapter, you talk about the missionaries responding to failure. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how failure is something ultimately instructive to missionaries in China and how they understand their own failures as a way to sort of change their tactics.
Right. Great. I think there was a bit of a paradox when I was doing research on the book, which is, in most of the narratives that I read or the historiographical narratives, the 19th century was this period of missionary optimism. And you see this a lot in a lot of the missionary rhetoric. Perhaps the most famous example of the sort of missionary optimism in the 19th century or the late 19th century, early 20th century, was when John Mott famously said, we're going to evangelize the world in a generation, that we're going to conquer the world. And there's all this talk in the 19th century by missionaries about this real confidence that missionaries are going to sort of just march through the world and Christianize all these parts that they previously had no access to, and now they had access to them through the steamship or through the railway. But when I read many of these missionary accounts, either letters from missionaries back to their superiors, or even within the missionary journals themselves, or at reports at missionary conferences, oftentimes I was just surprised by how open missionaries were about their failures. They were constantly talking about how their evangelization tactics were failing, how they weren't able to really sort of make progress on the ground. In personal letters, missionaries often wrote about their loneliness, about how homesick they were. Missionary attrition rates were also extremely high. Missionaries oftentimes got sick in the field and died. So there are all these instances, and then there's also the political realities of not being able to convert people on the ground. So throughout the 19th century in China, for example, there are huge anti-Christian demonstrations and also anti-Christian violence. The most sort of violent, throughout the 1870s, there's anti-Christian violence on the ground. And in the 1890s worldwide, there are these series of anti-Christian sort of outbursts from Africa to China, and perhaps the most violent of them being the Boxer Uprising in 1900. Mm-hmm. So you have all of these sort of political realities where missionaries are failing. And so I was just struck by that sort of paradox where on one hand, there was this sort of historiographical or to some extent, the missionaries would also talk about this sort of missionary optimism. But on the other hand, there was this real sort of sense of failure. So I sort of honed in on these missionary reports about their own failures. And I realized that the missionaries were slowly but surely learning from their failures. They were actually responding in these missionary conferences and at these journals to this overwhelming sense of failure that they felt. And one of the tactics that they started to embrace very slowly in the 19th century was that they started to turn towards indigenization or turn towards indigenous converts. And it was very slow and it wasn't across the board, but missionaries both on the Protestant and the Catholic side started to recognize in the late 19th century that the best way to convert people was to devolve power more quickly. But there was still a real reluctance to it and a lot of debate about how to do that.
Well, and one of the sort of tensions that then emerges at that point is whether or not Chinese Christians are mature enough to sort of handle their own churches, right? And you mentioned that while African Christians are sort of left to their own devices, there's all this debate about not only logistical debate about how to do this, but also whether or not they should handle this. And then at that point, we start to see sort of agitation. We start to see agitation from Chinese Christians themselves about having more independence. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Exactly. And this is the interesting thing about doing this sort of comparative work too, and it ties back to your previous question about why China, which is that the missionaries did have this idea of China as a civilizational competitor or a civilizational alternative. And this dates back to the early modern period when the Jesuits are there. But there's this real idea that and a lot of this in the 19th century is also mixed in with a relationship to anthropology and sort of the emergence of race studies. But there's this idea that In China, because China has this longer civilization, there's more of a resistance to China's conversion to Christianity, as opposed to Africa, which supposedly has no quote unquote civilization and therefore is more ripe for conversion. So there's this real idea here in China that missionaries really need to sort of tackle or grapple with the civilization that's on the ground. And they call this, you know, sort of Confucianism. And in order to sort of to convert the Chinese, you have to either delegitimize Confucianism, convince the Chinese that Confucianism is outdated, outmoded, or in some other way, shape, or form, get rid of Confucianism altogether. So there's this idea that the major stumbling block in the 19th century to China's Christianization is the continuing grasp that or hold that Confucianism has on the Chinese population. Now, this and like you said, at the same time that missionaries are putting forth these ideas in the late 19th century, early 20th century, you start to have a cohort of Chinese Christians who had the first sort of, Catholic conversion has many centuries, but Protestants, really, this would have been the second generation of Christian converts who are increasingly getting more confidence in their beliefs. So they're also pushing back on the missionaries and trying to get sort of more power and more local authority on the ground from both Catholic and Protestant missionary societies as well. And how that plays out too is that they're also pushing back in terms of how they see the relationship between traditional Chinese culture or Confucianism and Christianity too.
This all, and all of this is unfolding against a backdrop of this new emerging form of Chinese nationalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which
right.
They have to sort of, and the Chinese Christians have to deal with this, right? And they have to sort of figure out how to explain Christianity and interpret Christianity as something that's not just an import. Can you talk a little bit about how nationalism and Christianity are in tension or not at various points at that moment?
Yeah. So there's a real tension in the sense that with the rise of Chinese nationalism, and especially with the overturning of the Qing dynasty, sort of local elites or educated local elites at the ground have different sort of employment opportunities than they had before. So and I'm sure we'll talk about this later, especially as we get into the 1920s, the missionary societies see a lot of the Chinese Christians that they're trying to recruit essentially go to the nationalist government and start to work for the nationalist government. But even before the overturning of the Qing dynasty, essentially you start to have these nationalist calls to expel Christianity from the border. And a lot of this had to do with seeing Christianity as essentially foreign imperialism or foreign imperialists, and tying Christianity with the foreign imperial powers. So this put Chinese Christians in this very awkward middle position between their missionary supervisors or the people who essentially paid for their living or for their education. And essentially, this rising tide of nationalism that's swelling in the countryside and also across the country at large. So Chinese Christians are sort of put in this awkward position. And especially as Chinese Christians gain increasing prominence, a new generation of Chinese intellectuals emerge, especially in the 19-teens. They're increasingly putting more pressure on their missionary supervisors to say, look, if you want Christianity to succeed, we really need to get rid of this relationship to foreign imperialism. We really need to have more independent local authority. And at the same time, they're trying to defend Christianity to their Chinese counterparts, who are increasingly are attacking Christianity with increasing sort of intellectual fervor and also political fervor.
Now you have World War I as sort of a, I don't know if you would think of it as a turning point, but as mm-hmm. I was reading, it kind of seems like a bit of a turning point in the way missionaries are both received and the way Chinese Christians are able to operate. Could you maybe explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So World War I is definitely what I see as sort of the breaking point that fractures the missionary landscape and also the Chinese Christian landscape along several different lines. And these lines had already started to emerge before the First World War, but it's really the First World War that sort of blows it all apart. One line is one that we just talked about, which is the rise of sort of Chinese Christian intellectuals and Chinese intellectuals who are increasingly more critical of Christianity. But also within the Western missionary sphere, the First World War also fractures a series of these different alliances that had previously seemed to have been improving. Primarily for the Germans, this was cooperation with American or British missionaries. For German Protestants. Mm-hmm. So before the First World War, German Protestants had started to engage in ecumenical cooperation with American and British missionaries. They started to go to these conferences. They were talking about cooperation. A lot of it was very reluctant. But Germans oftentimes considered their Anglo-American counterparts as theologically naive or mm-hmm. a little too optimistic. But for the most part, before the First World War, they were willing to engage in that sort of dialogue and exchange. But after the First World War, primarily because of this clause in the Versailles Treaty or an article in the Versailles Treaty that the Anglo-Americans had helped to push through, Article 438, which confiscated German missionary properties, the Germans felt betrayed by their Anglo-American missionary counterparts. The Anglo-Americans basically said, we're basically holding on to these missionary properties to prevent them from being stolen by the secular state. But the Germans didn't really believe that. And so after the First World War, the Germans essentially become more nationalistic on the Protestant side. They start to join in more German-speaking alliances in China. They sort of bury some theological disagreements with other German-speaking missionary societies that they had engaged in the 19th century. So on the Protestant side, there's this split between these different missionary nations as a result of the First World War. On the Catholic side, the story is slightly different, which is that the SVD or German Catholics in general can rely on the emergence of the Vatican as a major diplomatic force, and also their international character. So the German Catholic Missionary Society has an American branch that they had started to set up in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so they had American allies who could lobby for them. And they also had the Vatican who could push for them in these major sort of diplomatic arenas. So what you see for the German Catholics is that they start growing closer and increasingly sort of more oriented towards Vatican directives. And what's happening at the Vatican is that the Vatican is also adopting new approaches to missionary work. The Pope, who dies very shortly after the First World War, Benedict XV, is very much committed to this idea of indigenous clergy and engagement with local sort of cultures. So what you see is that the German Catholics also start to sort of push in that direction as well. So you have these three different, I sort of see them, three different spheres in which people are operating in. The Chinese intellectuals who are increasingly influenced by nationalism and nationalist critiques of Christianity. The Chinese Christians who are also pushing for more power on the ground. And then you have these Western missionary groups that are fragmented along national lines. But you also have these sort of international groups like the Vatican who are sort of trying to work in between these different missionary organizations and also nations as well.
Now, one thing that I thought was pretty cool that seems to at least really and unexpected to me is that after the First World War, so a lot of these missionaries are feeling threatened by secularism, you know, and some of the Catholic ones are like, oh my gosh, it's a new Kulturkampf. And so in China, as you've just been saying, you know, they start to look anew at indigenization as a model for the church. And one thing in particular is that both Protestants and Catholics start to chill out about Confucianism. What is that all about?
Right. So this is also the unexpected finding that I found, which is, you know, when you look at most of these missionary journals in the 19th century, I sort of mentioned this previously, they were talking about, you know, getting rid of Confucianism. They're often talking about Confucianism, Confucius himself as being this sort of snake charmer who had misled the Chinese, had set up all of the stumbling blocks for China's subsequent backwardness, and had prevented, essentially Confucius's ideas as preventing China's modernization. But by the 1920s and the 1930s, missionaries completely changed their tune. I mean, they're talking about Confucius as this sort of as a world historical figure. And perhaps the most obvious example that I found was this Berlin missionary named Karl Johannes Voskamp. And before the war, he was essentially one of the most vehement anti-Confucian voices on the scene. And he wrote a series of pamphlets essentially denouncing Confucius. And after 1919, he no longer publishes any anti-Confucian tracts. And he basically starts to talk about Confucius as a Christ-like figure. That another missionary, this is a Catholic missionary, says, I think at one point he says, you know, as Confucius rises, so does Christ. So missionaries start to see sort of Christ and Confucius as inseparable, as their fates in China as sort of linked together. And part of the reason that I see this this alliance is because basically missionaries both on the Catholic and Protestant side, see Confucianism as no longer a threat. That the bigger threat on the world stage and also the stage in China is the rise of communism and this sort of global secular atheist secular force. Part of this is the German missionary experience in Germany, where they see the November Revolution and they see the rise of the German left. But also part of this is that they are sort of being threatened and surrounded in China as well. The rise of these sort of Chinese secular nationalists who are criticizing Christianity, but also on the ground in many of their missionary stations are being attacked by sort of what they consider communist robbers. So by the 1920s, essentially, these German missionaries, both Protestant and Catholics, see communism or this sort of global secular left as the bigger threat on the stage. And in order to survive in China, they reach out to their former foes, the Confucians, and they say, well, at least we can build an alliance with the Confucians in China, because they're something that they're somewhat similar to us. They're a religion. They respect family values. They're traditional. So we can sort of have this quote unquote religious alliance on the ground in China. And part of this also is that they're saying Germany and China after the war are spiritually brothers now, or spiritually tied, because we've both been on the quote unquote losing side of the war. So, mm-hmm. So it's this sort of complicated confluence of these different factors, but essentially I see it as that they're choosing Confucianism as a political ally because they see Confucianism as no longer their major threat in China.
And there are an awful lot of threats in China. Right. It's been a while since I've taken Chinese history, but I'm, you know, this very tumultuous period where we've got rising nationalism, we've got the Japanese looming on the horizon, right. And it seems like the Second World War really sort of changes some Chinese Christian thinking about how independent they can really be, and they sort of become convinced that they need foreign help. Can you speak a little bit about that?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. So essentially, one of the through lines that I trace throughout the book is this idea of, you know, so when did Chinese Christians actually become independent in these two societies? And I was just surprised that that the independence of the Chinese Christians come so late, that it comes basically for both missionary societies essentially in the 1930s. And on both sides, essentially it's because of the war that financially they're unable to continue, especially for the Protestants, but also for the Catholics. They're financially unable to continue supporting the missions in the same way. So they are forced to give up power and devolve power to local Chinese Christians. But when this actually happens, when they actually do devolve power and sort of give over this missionary control or control of the local congregations to the Chinese Christians, it turns out that many of the Chinese Christians are unhappy with this, because this means that they're cut off from resources, they're cut off from their monthly stipends, or they're cut off from the ability to sort of fix their chapels and that sort of stuff, especially during wartime. And what I found in the archives is actually that there were oftentimes letters written by the Chinese Christian leaders asking the Germans to continue to support, to continue to give them support, and not to sort of leave them behind. So it becomes this real story about political destabilization and how this destabilizing broader context really sort of shifts the way people talk about indigenization, where on the one hand, the Germans, who had previously been very reluctant to indigenize, now say, okay, so we're going to give over control. And then the Chinese, who had previously said, hey, give us more control, now are saying, actually, maybe we want you to stay a little bit longer. So the positions are sort of constantly shifting because of the sort of unstable political situation that surrounds them.
And of course, things don't get a huge amount better after the war, because we finally get this, well, a victory of the communists. And then you do this really interesting thing towards the end of the book where you kind of trace the experiences of Ling and Chen, Mr. Ling and Mr. Chen, and how they sort of accommodate themselves and their thinking and practices to communism and its antipathy to religion across the board. Can you speak a little bit about them?
Right. So I essentially wanted to trace two members, I'll back up a little. The hardest part about writing histories of Christianity in China is actually getting to the voices of Chinese Christians themselves, because oftentimes they're mediated either through the missionary society, or many of those sources in China themselves are either inaccessible or they're gone. So I was trying really hard to get at the voices of these on the ground Chinese Christians. And I still don't think I was able to really get to a congregational member who was sitting in the pews. And the closest I could get were people who had been trained by the missionary societies or were affiliated with the missionary societies and had risen to some form of prominence and had left behind some writing. And so on the Catholic side, I wrote about Chen Yuan, who was who became the president of the university that the missionary society ran and was very close to the missionary society. And on the other hand, on the Protestant side, I wrote about Ling Deyuan, who otherwise would not be known in Chinese history, but was basically a local pastor raised by the Berlin Missionary Society. He was basically a product of the Berlin Missionary Society's educational systems from a very young age up until they left. I need to add too that Chen Yuan is the president of Furen University was a very prominent historian of Chinese religion. So within sort of Chinese history, he's quite well known. But the reason why I wanted to choose them is that both of them, essentially after the communists came to power, both Ling and Chen repudiate their former missionary supervisors. They basically sort of sign these statements. Chen Yuan, for the most part, was the most vehement. He said, you know, I was mistaken by associating myself with these foreign missionaries. They were all Western imperialists. At the time, I was mistaken. And Ling Deyuan, the pastor for the Berlin Missionary Society, essentially does the same thing. He signs a manifesto that sort of repudiates his past. And I think how they've been treated in how Chinese Christians like Ling and Chen have been treated in the historiography, oftentimes they've been sort of portrayed as traitors or people who had betrayed their Christian faith, people who who didn't really sort of, who weren't quote unquote really Christian. And the real Christians are those who had suffered under the communist regime. And these oftentimes in the West are people that we sort of have heard about, like Watchman Nee, who were sort of put in prison by the Communist Party, and they were quote unquote the true believers who suffered for their faith. And I've always had a bit of a problem with that narrative, because I think it doesn't really put into real focus the dilemma that these Chinese Christians like Chen and Ling had to go through, and also sort of the real sort of political crises that they were surrounded by. And I think for somebody like a local pastor like Ling, for him, the biggest question was, how do I keep the missionaries? How do I keep the church running? How do I keep my congregation fed? How do I just sort of essentially keep the lights on? And for a period of time, it was, you know, trying to get the Germans to continue to invest in the mission. And now that the Chinese communists have come, I'm going to have to accommodate to them and sort of make a political compromise with them in order to keep the congregation running. And in that sense, he does succeed. He essentially makes a compromise with the Chinese communist state, but he's able to continue to sort of function at the local level as a pastor, albeit as one that is sponsored by the Chinese Communist Party. For intellectuals like Chen, on the other hand, I think he's put in much more of a difficult position, in the sense that he's forced to make sort of statements that sort of repudiate his past. And I think for intellectuals like Chen, it's a real tragedy, in the sense that he really has to sort of turn his back on all of the major accomplishments that I think he was able to sort of try to push forward in the 1930s and 40s, which is this idea of a more tolerant China, one which is religiously diverse and open. And that was sort of the basis of his scholarship in the 1920s and 30s, which is he was looking into the past, in previous periods in China, when China was open to all these different religious influences. And he was thinking about how to reconstruct a new China based on this sort of religiously tolerant model. And for him, this was the sort of the early period of the Yuan dynasty of the Mongols, when there was this sort of religious diversity. And I think the real tragedy for intellectuals like Chen is that he one doesn't really see that that model come to fruition before his death, but also that publicly he has to sort of renounce all of those positions that I think he probably still held on to until his death.
Okay. Well, we've taken up quite a bit of your time. Now, I guess my final question is, what are you working on next? You said you're at a second book project. How's that going?
It's going slower than than I'd like. The second book project is partly an emergence from the first. As I was doing work on missionaries, it's hard not to come across their medical work. And missionaries were sort of the main forces in setting up hospitals and medical colleges in China. And when I was working on the book, I always thought, okay, I'll just sort of table this and come back to it. So now I'm sort of coming back to it. But more broadly, I'm interested in global health governance. And I'm not only looking at missionaries for this second project. I'm starting to move into more quote unquote secular international organizations, and it'll probably be focused more on the 20s and 30s. So, looking at what these international health organizations like the League of Nations, health organizations are doing in China. And I'm sort of, I want to compare what, you know, secular doctors are doing compared to sort of medical missionaries. And I've sort of identified several organizations that I'm interested in. So since I've been in Paris, I've been using the Pasteur Institute archives, and the Pasteur Institute set up a lab in China, but also looking at these other European tropical medicine institutes. So this year, when I'm in, as I've been in Germany, I've been at the Hamburg Tropical Medical Institute, and they sent people to China as well. And essentially, I want to think about how what these doctors learn in China. And I guess it's sort of a continuation of my first project, in the sense that my first project was very much interested in what German missionaries or European missionaries learn from China and what they bring back with them to Europe. And I guess I'm sort of similarly interested in what European doctors learn from East Asia and bring back with them to Europe from their travels and their work in Asia.
Well, that actually sounds really cool, and I will have to talk to you as soon as that one comes out.
So, I'd love
Albert,
that.
Albert, thank you so much for today, and I really enjoyed our conversation. And you take care of yourself.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation as well, and thanks again for having me. I really had a good time.
You've been listening to an interview with Albert Wu, author of From Christ to Confucius, German Missionaries, Chinese Christians, and the Globalization of Christianity, 1860 to 1950, on the New Books in German Studies podcast. You can download other interviews with scholars of German studies on iTunes or at newbooksnetwork.com under category, People and Places, German Studies. Thank you for listening.